This is Robert Greenway, October 28, 1991. Psychoecology, also known as the human-nature relationship.
I think now we're ready to begin. Welcome to you all. Came out on this dark, cold, wet night to another lecture here at the Jung Society. And we appreciate that since you can't have a lecture without an audience, really. It's sort of pointless. My name is Gordon Keating, and I'm on the program committee for the Jung Society. And I wanted to just, before we get into tonight's talk, to tell you about some upcoming events that are happening. We've had a lot of programs already this fall, but we still have to go before the end of this year. Three more lectures and... three more lectures
and then a workshop too, and I'll tell you about those.
Robert Greenway, who is a psychologist. He lives in Port Townsend, and he also, at the same time, works as an associate professor in Northern California. He just explained to me how he's doing that.
Synchronicity,
yeah. He has been interested in Jungian psychology and archetypal psychology for a long time, and he is interested in applying these ideas to areas of wilderness psychology. He actually takes groups of people out into the wilderness, and a lot of this, I think, has to do with sort of exploring the wild part of our nature. The topic that he's talking on tonight is called the human-nature relationship. Please welcome Robert Greenway.
Well, thank you very much for coming out. When I was in graduate school many years ago, I went to Brandeis in Boston, and those were the days when Abraham Maslow was at the peak of his fame. And so we were deeply immersed in humanistic psychology. We thought at that time that we understood what that meant. And we were, of course, given classes in Jungian psychology. And I remember the thing we always used to say was, well, we'll do that on rainy nights in the Northwest. That's where you put Jungian psychology, in the rainy nights. And I was thinking about that when I was coming down this afternoon. It was snowing in Fort Townsend when I left, and I was coming down, it was raining, and I remembered that phrase very vividly, and I thought, this is not exactly what I think we had in our minds, but I want you to know very clearly what my credentials are, if any, and what my relationship to Jung is fairly accurately. I don't want to be a pretender in Jungian things, but I do have an interest in using it. But it is accurate to say that I have seen Jung as an avocation or as an aspect of a larger theory. And I know for those of you who are immersed in Jung and see the immensity of his contribution, that may sound kind of strange. So I'm a user of Jung and not a full understander of the immensity of his system and so forth. And I do like Jung on rainy nights just to scare myself, you know. I'd like to say a couple things about myself. One of the reasons I came down was to give a really short summary. I can't do too much justice to it. This is a summary of a course that I take 60 hours to teach, and I always feel hampered when I do that. And it's a summary of a book that I'm working on, which is very dangerous. I was telling Gordon to come and try to speak about a book when it's just in the middle of it, because you tend to go kind of berserk in eight directions at once. So I brought notes, and I didn't want to make a formal talk, and I'm very much hoping to be able to interact with you in questions, and I very much like to be interrupted. So if I say anything remotely interesting to you, please say, would you say something more about that? Or if you have a comment that you like to make as I go along, I'd be grateful if you'd stay in touch. Because I'm not really interested in just presenting stuff in the abstract that really doesn't have your interest. So I'd appreciate that. I'm hoping to continue to understand more about what the Jungian people do in Seattle, and I'm hoping also to understand why more and more Jungian people seem to be moving to Port Townsend. There's an interesting psycho-ecological issue right there. So where I'm coming from, I was born in Seattle, and I returned here in the middle 1940s after World War II. My father was sent back up here, and I was a boy. And I fell into this country in a way that many people do. I fell into it in a wild and natural way. I grew up in the north end of Seattle, when we could still catch native cutthroat trout right along Matthews Beach out there, where Matthews Creek comes down there. That was my hangout place, and it was wilderness. It was back up the creek, very wild land. So that's imprinted on me. We would go out skiing. We'd leave about Thursday, and we'd get back about Tuesday, and call it a long weekend. And we would take cases of beer and army surplus tents, glass bottles and things. How we survived it, I'm not sure. Go up to Snoqualmie Pass and Stevens Pass. And growing up was an incredible experience. 8 of my friends were killed in mountain accidents during that time. There was a whole rash of crevasse accidents. And my best friend was killed by lightning forget the name of the peak, in the Cascades. And we sailed and pulled our boats up on beaches and ate off the beaches for weeks at a time. We ate well and just drifted around the Sound for months at a time. Fought with each other to get the best crewing positions on the fanciest yachts that would go out in the Swiftsure Lightship Race. I stumbled into the University of Washington. Actually, that's not exactly accurate. I was avoiding all education as much as possible and was training for the Olympics and skiing. And my father, who was connected with the Army, sent me a wire and said, congratulations, you're number one in the Seattle Draft Board. This was when the Korean War was beginning to get going. And in those days, they didn't have computers. They had long, long lines wending their way into registration at the university. And I lied my way in. I never graduated from high school, and I lied my way into the university. And it took them, in those days, 6 weeks to find out that I was there illegally. And I'd been making sure I did very well. I majored in physics and meteorology and forestry my first year at the university. And went from there to writing and zoology and botany. I was that kind of a kid. I was pretty confused. I stumbled into the first teacher I'd ever had. His name is Tommy Edmondson, and he's still emeritus at the university in limnology. And he said, look, you like to sail. I like to sail. I need somebody to go out with me. And I found a teacher, and we studied Lake Washington. And those were the days when Tommy Edmondson taught the city of Seattle that the treated sewage that they were putting in the lake was killing the lake. People couldn't understand that in those days. It sounded like a good thing to do. You treat the sewage, and then it's clean, and you dump it in the lake. And they didn't realize that it was pure fertilizer that was raising the nitrogen content enough so the algae was beginning to get very serious. And we studied the lake and figured out what the future would be if it continued in the direction it was going. And Seattle passed the first metro sewage treatment line around the lake in the country not too long after that. And I'm very pleased to be able to come back to the lake and bring my children and my grandchildren and point out to them that it's cleaner now than when I was a kid. So that's the good news. The bad news is that they just dump everything now over in the sound, and my friends who study these things are telling me that we are now at the threshold of when the sound is definitely going to show the cumulative effects of what we've been doing to it for a long, long time. So I grew up with these things. I'm interested in these things. This is a very rough social statement of what I mean by psychoecology. I'm interested in the psychology of ecological issues. I'm interested in why people will vote for something and why they won't. Why people can go through periods of denial in the vivid face of catastrophe. And of course, this gets into all sorts of other psychologies. But the issue of addiction and the issue of denial with regard to what's happening with our environmental situation is very, very clear to me, and I think to a lot of people. I'm sure most of you probably share this idea. So anyway, I drifted out of Washington, University of Washington, with graduate work in limnology, and ended up writing for Sunset Magazine, and then ended up at Brandeis in psychology for reasons much too complex to describe, and ended up a psychologist working for the Peace Corps. And in the Peace Corps, I began training volunteers and found out that the best way to train them and get them ready for the trauma of another culture was to take them into the wilderness and get them as lost as I could possibly get them, and then watch what happened when they came back into the culture. So I began studying the culture-nature relationship as a way of training Peace Corps volunteers to be flexible enough or tough enough, whatever the word is, to be Kennedy-esque saviors of third-world countries with virtually no training whatsoever, just Kennedy's assumption that growing up in America was enough. And a history major was as good as an agriculture major. All we had to do was get them over there, and they could do that. My second job in the Peace Corps, you may think I'm digressing. Maybe I am, but I think this is the point. My second job in the Peace Corps was dealing with volunteers who were having breakdowns. And this was in the 1960s, and unbeknownst to the American public, about one-third of all the volunteers overseas were having serious mental difficulty, breakdowns, and they were incapacitated. And one of the reasons, again, was the culture shock of being in one culture and suddenly being picked up and taken to another culture. Of course, meanwhile, interestingly, parallel things were happening in Vietnam. So we had an entire generation at all levels. We had the elite from Berkeley and Cornell and Harvard going overseas, and we had the people of color going over to Vietnam, and also all sorts of people going over to Vietnam as well. And we had them all pouring back into the country in states of semi-culture shock. And I have a sort of an anthropological theory that a lot of what happened in that famous year of 1968 was when a lot of this stuff came to a head. And when the level of culture change and culture shock reached a certain threshold and then tilted over, many other things were going on too, of course, as you all know. So I ended up as an administrator at UC Santa Cruz, and that was during the days of riots in California, and then ended up at Sonoma State University as a psychology professor. And they said, "What would you like to do?" By that time, I was so bloodied from various strange institutions that I didn't believe them for 2 years. And they meant it. They said, "Do what you wish to do. We like your background and we like your work, what you like to do." So I started taking students out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time to explore various things. The first time I did it was in a fit of anger at a group of students who were hassling me about a counterculture and about various utopian visions of what society would be. And I said, "All right, let's put up or shut up. Let's go out and set up exactly what you want. Let's see how it would work. No drugs, but let's see how it would work. And, so we went out for about 6 weeks, and the psychological changes and the experiential quality of the learning that happened really made it impossible for me to teach at the university from then on without a fairly major experiential component in my classes. So I developed a wilderness program. It's fairly unique in the country, and it's still going on. It's a wilderness psychology program, and we train people to be wilderness leaders to take other people who have various healing needs out into the wilderness. And the reason I got into theory as intensely as I did, because as we train people to come back in from deep-level wilderness experiences back into the culture, it wasn't enough, if you wanted to get a job anyway, to just say, you know, wow. It's really great, you know. And so we began looking for a language. It was that simple. We began combing the psychologies for a language that would express what is, in essence, a very, very deep level, what we would call a spiritual experience. I see it very parallel to psychedelic experiences. I see it very parallel to Eastern contemplative practices. There's the wilderness, there's psychedelic experiences, there's Eastern contemplative practices. Perhaps certain kinds of depth therapy reach that same level. I'm skeptical of that. But I know that there are various ways that people throughout history and now our particular culture is using to try to balance what is an extremely imbalanced culture. And that's the premise from which I'm working. So the wilderness is offering something that is extremely powerful and efficient and spectacular, and exactly how it does it, exactly what is going on. It's like one of those things, you know, that everybody knows, but when you come to try to find a language, you know, you just go kind of clunk, you know. Well, what happened was we sat around the fire and then went off, and we were alone for 3 days, and it was an incredible experience. And then we came back, you know, and everybody will look at you and say, yes, you know, could you say some more, you know? And you've just been through an experience that is among the most numinous of all experiences that a person can have in life, and you find yourself unable to speak about it, except maybe in dance or poetry or art, which is something that police captains and school superintendents don't generally buy if you want to try to develop a program for a high school or a program for an agency that has lots of schizophrenics or something like that. So we combed the psychologies, immediately found a lot of interest in transpersonal psychology, and I've spent about 10 years really mastering that language, those languages, as best as I could. At about the same time, I turned back to Jung in my earlier rainy night studies of Jung. And I found considerable benefit from Jung, and I've found some benefit from transpersonal languages, virtually no benefit whatsoever from the other psychologies, self-psychologies and those areas, transactional psychologies, you know, have been beneficial to some degree. I'll try to get into a little more theoretical details if any of you are interested in going in that direction. But that's how I came to develop what I call a field called psychoecology. It's you know, it's no big deal. It's a study of language of the wound, what I call the wound. And my assumption is there is a wound inherent in our culture that is a very serious nature culturally. It's a disjunction, and the languages that we can describe for healing of that wound are various and many and contradictory, and perhaps maybe not even there. Okay, so far. Not going fast enough, am I? So that's just my introduction. So. So I'm moving right along. I've drawn from ecology, which to me means systems of energy. I've drawn from philosophy. The greatest rich source of understanding of the culture-nature split has been John Dewey, of all the interesting people I've stumbled into. He's terrible to read, 1930, turgid style, every sentence takes a half an hour. But if you compare John Dewey with Gregory Bateson, John Dewey is much clearer and much more complete. Gregory Bateson is very exciting. John Dewey is very, very rich. The word that comes up is dualism. Dualism is the philosophical statement of the womb that we're living in. What we find out psychologically is that when you are inside of a dualism, you are not aware that you are in a dualism. You are inside of it. So as you begin to step back from a dualism, you begin to step back and enter into a sense of paradox. The paradox is the symptom of coming out of dualism. In other words, when two things begin to seem like they're true at the same time, you're beginning to see two things beginning to appear to be true at the same time, then something strange is going on. Dewey is a philosopher of that situation. And he has very much to say. His book, Experience in Nature, I would recommend. Jung knew about him, and they read each other's work. And Dewey knew about Jung, and both of them cherished William James. They were both tremendously tuned in to William James. And much of that heritage and that strain of what I think is very great help for our current crisis has been lost until recently, and various people are picking up Dewey again and finding interesting things. Psychoecology means physics and the quantum probabilities, and now the chaos theory. It's very excitingly meshed in. I'll just rush through that. Theology, Teilhard de Chardin and Thomas Berry, who I cherish in his work. Biology, some of the more out on the edge biologies, of course, like Sheldrake's work, morphic resonance is a part of this psychoecology mix. And then, interestingly, poetry. I have found more help in poetry and poetics than I have in any psychology for language to express psychoecological truth. Michael McClure, one of the San Francisco beat poets, is a masterful psychoecology. He's a masterful biologist and a master, and I recommend him to you, especially in person. You usually don't get what a poet has, at least my bias is, until you really can hear the resonance of their voice. Susan Griffin brought to me on a platter, in essence, the issue that it could just be that women are seeing the human nature split, maybe just a little bit different than men see it. And her book, Woman and Nature, subtitled The Roaring Inside of Her, is, I would say, is one of the essential texts for understanding our situation. Just my bias. Pardon me? Susan Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, Berkeley poet. She's written a number of incredible books. Transpersonal psychology, deep ecology, ecofeminism, all of these are gathering momentum and coming down into what is really getting to be a sense of coherence. Nobody's really quite satisfied with deep ecology, who works on it very deeply anyway and philosophically. It does not work. It is not consistent. It's like a commotion and a flailing around. Deep means something different to everyone who uses the term. Deep means dreams. Let's put dreams in ecology. Okay. Let's put archetypes in ecology. Okay. Let's put, whatever we can do to express the unconscious, you know, in ecology, and then we'll call it deep ecology. And there's great beauty in it, but it's not as a coherent language. It isn't working. Ecofeminism has similar problems, in my opinion. And I say that with some trepidation because there's much about it that I don't understand. There's much that is extremely valuable. The difficulty in ecofeminism is that it is latched onto as an ideology so fast that it's fixed. It's fixed out of the flow or out of the system. And it becomes another form of dualism. When you do that, when you stop the flow of a system and isolate out, which is what our consciousness tends to do, that's what our culture tends to reinforce in our particular culture, stopping and isolating and fixing on it. When you start to do that, to a certain point, then it becomes disjunctive and you become split and you have two principles of reality operating. You have, you know, the famous ones, mind and body split. That's the famous one. Humans and spirit, humans and God. God's ways are not man's ways, for example. Pure dualism. When you have male and female consciousness and psychology split to the point of having fundamental principles operating differently, and again, you're losing the interrelationship of nature. Dewey's view, and of course all mystics throughout history, is that it is all one. We are dealing with one reality. And so dualism, the way I would define it, is a split in reality that is total. A disjunction is getting very near a dualism. A distinction is not a dualism at all. A distinction is a very happy and exciting and healthy thing. Disjunction is beginning to really rip apart. A dualism is a full-blown disjunction. It's a full-blown split. And if our habit of thinking, I'll jump to one of my conclusions, if our habit of thinking, if we are as a culture addicted to that kind of thinking, then we will tend to be split from nature in a very fundamental and problematical way. And cognitively and psychologically, we will be split and inside of a split that will not show us the path out of the split. So that's why I take people to the wilderness, and that's why I try to find the language to talk about it. I want to get to Jung for a few minutes before we have a break. A quote from Jung. I'm going to read several quotes from Jung, not quite randomly, but I'm going to lead into some quotes about archetypes and a few quotes about synchronicity, and try to bring that back to this introduction I'm giving to what I'm calling psychoecology. This is from his collected works, Book 9. The kind of circumscribing of consciousness provided by archetypes is, in fact, open, not localized, an individual ego consciousness, but the archetype acts like a circumambient atmosphere to which no definite limits can be set, either in space or in time. Hence the synchronistic phenomena so often associated with activated archetypes. In one swoop, he's linked together archetypes and synchronicity. You drop into the archetype, if the archetype is working through your levels of consciousness, as we would say in transpersonal psychology, the archetype is working, then you are, in fact, out of individual consciousness. You're connecting with something that is collective and shared, and you begin to experience synchronistic experiences. In other words, you're experiencing the archetype below the individual consciousness that other people are experiencing too. And you'll run into those other people. You'll be bumping into them, as it were, speaking from an individual standpoint. Maybe you can get just a glimmer of the difficulty of what we're trying to find language for. How can we speak of these things? How can we speak of archetypes? The thing I love about Jung the most, he gave at least 10 identifiably different definitions of archetypes, and gloried in that. He didn't apologize for that, as you know, and gave good reasons, and still called himself a scientist, but always was coming with a different definition of archetype. Those 10 definitions of archetypes have spawned 10 post-Jungian schools. There's the Hillman School and the von Franz School, and they all have taken a different definition of his archetype and kind of run with that, which I think is unfortunate, because I think the juice is when you get all 10 definitions and kind of put them in the pot and see what happens. And I encourage you to do that. An awful lot happens. The archetypes are complementary equivalents of the outside world and therefore possess a cosmic character. This explains their numinosity and their godlikeness. Archetypes are complementary. That's a whole chapter in itself. Okay, so far? Faster, slower? Okay. I get lost in this stuff. I'm asking if Jung and his work, his understanding, concepts in his language, with regard to psychological processes, will help us out of this split. That's simply put, that's what I'm asking. Nature is infinitely beautiful, pleasing to the senses, satisfying to the mind. That's one of the statement from. And he was deeply aware of the aesthetics of nature. Science can be a channel to this beauty. These are assumptions that he made and that I'm willing to at least consider. The careful studies of plants and wildflowers and mycorrhiza and things like that are channels into this beauty. Nature is therefore an essential ground of healing. There is something that can happen in that opening fully, like that surrender to nature, that's absolutely essential for our survival. Nature is sensuality, a source of sensuality and a context for the erotic. There's absolutely no way to avoid sensuality and the erotic if you're going to drop below the constraints of culture where the archetypes are doing their various dances and as we know from mythology and so forth. See what else we have here. What do the archetypes do? Focus on those just for a moment. They're ultimately coherent. Very, very interesting thing about archetypes. Jung said again and again that the archetypes are not the image. The image is what we know. The image is cultural. And so we, again, that's our dualistic tendency to use our egoic consciousness to define what is really below what the ego could define, if you will. It is something numinous. It is something more profound than it could define. But it is knowable. They're nevertheless knowable. When you think of the range of archetypes that we find, for example, in the range of archetypal images that we find in mythology, for men, for women, you know, the hero, Artemis, Hercules, and Narcissus, and so forth, you find varieties of containers that appear to have archetypal juice, but have been fully acculturated to the point that you can't feel the connection, maybe crossing cultures, or you can't feel the connection sometimes historically. So the archetypes are reawakened in every culture and in every period in history. There's containers that they emerge from. So there's great. I have great concern. You know, I love the people who do these things, but I have great concern about finding like the goddesses in every man and the goddesses in every woman, and taking as models for those goddesses and those gods historical patterns that whose cultures were so different than our current culture that it's virtually indescribable. I think my Peace Corps experience encourages me to do that. I lived and worked with way too many people who could not find a way to cross cultures in any significant way, to know that that's a very common thing. And I've worked in counseling with way too many men and women who are living in cosmically different worlds to know that, that we don't often connect and communicate as much as we think we do. They have a tendency, the archetypes appear, they have a tendency, a proclivity, experiences will be shaped by them in certain ways. So those images will shape our experience. They will guide us across as an archetypal image or as an archetypal symbol will guide us in certain ways and will appear again and again, a swastika, a star, in terms of images. These are things that are implanted and embedded in the depths of our psyches, as you know. They link biological inheritance with cultural inheritance. The mother, the breast, the father, the self, and God. These are linkages and bridges that link the transition through life. This is the way Jung saw them again and again. They are culturally shared. Common among long-term ethnic groups be gathered around the emergence of an archetype. The architecture of the collective unconscious is thus constructed in some way out of archetypes, Jung would say. They originated with him, he says in his Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. Here's a quote: in America with Freud analyzing each other's dreams. Dream of the house with many floors, the famous dream. And it's sitting on top of a cellar. And the cellar is sitting on top of a cave. And that was numinous for Jung, especially hanging around Freud, I guess. And he said, it was my first inkling of a collective a priori, something that existed, you know, that was in consciousness, but that existed throughout, beyond consciousness, that connected with other people, that connected with other eras in history, that connected with the cosmos, and yet was conscious. You know, he had this sense that that there was this incredible something else, you know. A couple more points, and then I'm going to do some definitions, and then we'll take a break. The experience of archetypes, so much of our behavior is rooted in them that it's possible to start thinking that archetypes are everything. That there's an archetype for everything, and everything is an archetype, and the whole concept begins to get very, very absurd. Falling in love, you can define it in archetypal terms, you know, the anima, the animus, projection of it, you know, and so forth. And so we've explained falling in love. Or screaming for sports teams. There hasn't been too much Jungian work on sports teams, but there well could be. Have you ever seen a more classical example of the hero archetype in baseball? Football, I think it has something to do with Neanderthal archetypes, you know, crashing in. But then out of this brutality and crashing of the tribe, you know, the primal horde crashing into each other, this kind of dainty, I've been living with the 49ers and Joe Montana for a long time, so I'm still in the thrall of them. Out of this brutal horde, this kind of dainty man will draw back and, you know, pass the ball down to the people. Somebody like Jerry Rice, who is not even touching the ground, and, you know, will dance like ballet dancers through this thing. But the batter gets up in baseball. He gets up, you know, all by himself. He gets up and faces. And what are they trying to do? What's he trying to do with the bat? He's trying to keep the ball from coming home. So he's batting it away from home and so forth. I mean, you know, you can go on with that for a long time. Is one of my favorite quotes from Jung. And I try to let it guide my work in taking people in the wilderness. The doctor who does not know from his own experience the numinosity of the archetype will scarcely be able to escape their negative effect when he encounters it in his practice. He will tend to over or underrate it since he possesses only an intellectual point of view. This is where these perilous aberrations begin, the first of which is the attempt to dominate everything by the intellect. This serves the secret purpose of placing both doctor and patient at a safe distance from the archetypal effect and thus from real experience, and of substituting for psychic reality an apparently secure, artificial, but merely two-dimensional conceptual world in which the reality of life is well covered by the so-called clear concepts. I'm sure he's justifying his murkiness in some ways, but I think he's right on the mark when it comes to archetypes. I'd like to stop if I still haven't burned up all my capital here, and I'd like to just stop and show a few definitions that seem to be going off on a tangent, but that I hope will come and connect with this archetypal stuff. This is drawn in some ways, this is drawn in part from cognitive psychology, which is one of my hobbies in artificial intelligence work, and is drawn from a lot of transpersonal psychology, primarily Ken Wilber's work. Work interests me a lot. Now I can, it'll pick up from there. I think that the semantic confusion surrounding these words is blocking our ability to find a psychology that will work for you. That's my premise. This is very hurried, but okay, consciousness. We all know what it is. There's not a single adequate definition of consciousness in any book. It is apparently impossible to define. I sometimes think that possibly it doesn't exist even, but at least we know it's impossible to define. But we all wake up in the morning and think we have it. And then we have what we call the near unconscious, which is the things that are dropping in and out of consciousness all the time. The remarkable thing is that some of the most interesting theorists say that consciousness is only about 3,000 years old. Julian James, for example, is one of my favorite writers. It's only about 3,000, 4,000, maybe 5,000 for most years old. We have all that other stuff that was happening in Egypt and Babylon and everything. Was done more or less, you know, voices talking in the head and stuff, but not what we know as consciousness. We're thrilled that it's fascinating theory. Anyway, we have the near unconscious. It's like you're not thinking about where your car is parked, but the minute I mention your car, you know where it is. The deeper unconscious, and this, of course, is the repressed areas of unconscious. And these are very hard to access. Freud, I think, was very accurate in his assessment of these areas. We have then what we call an archetypal area, archetypal unconscious, much deeper area. And we don't access this directly, perhaps very often, maybe rare a few times. The cosmic peak experiences, in Maslow's terms, are, some incredible shattering of consciousness and unconsciousness. Very difficult for this to be defined in terms other than psychosis in our particular culture. The interesting thing is that the Tibetans and transpersonal people are trying to, they go right on. This was the end of the unconscious. This was consciousness, and this is all unconsciousness. And we've been working with this, I think, oversimplistic model in therapies and other psychologies for a long time. And I don't think it works. The deeper areas, I would call this a zone, for example, where everything connects. There is a systemic, it's tuning into the system. And I think of archetypes, by the way, as the motif of the system. Every system in systems theory has a motif. It has a flavor to it. It has a direction or an aspect to it. Anyway, there's a zone, I think, below that where everything connects, only it's not things anymore. They're not things. And the physicists are hanging out in this area a lot these days. This is where the physicists are hanging out. And the Tibetan Buddhists go on about 13 more zones. And chuckle, you know, laugh. The more they get out here, the more they're laughing, and they say, oh, yeah, I'm Atman out here, or God, or everything else, you know, so forth. The interesting thing, the reason, you know, a multiple level of conscious, a multiple level model is essential for my work, because what happens, I get something like this happening, that someone goes to the wilderness, and I work with them for, say, 2 or 3 weeks in the wilderness, and they're sort of like this opening out, and every person will be different. There'll be a different, some people get really, they're stuck right at this age, stage, and other people are moving out here. It's very similar to experiments and research that was done with psychedelics, especially with people like Stan Grof and his work, if any of you are familiar with what he did. The breaking open of the psyche for periods of time, and then it's restructuring, it's returning. And I needed to find a way to express this. This is just the barest beginning of what is another book that's sitting in a box in Fort Townsend. What I wanted to get to, but the thing I'm trying to say most clearly about this is not all these zones. I mean, who knows? Of course they're all illusions, and of course they don't really exist like this. But they sort of do. Like, these things get walled off. And so when these boundaries get built up in certain ways, that's a more psychological way of looking at that philosophical way of dualism. The psychological, these divisions. What began to interest me, I began to look at consciousness, and I realized the Buddhists are always saying, transcend the ego. And I used to ponder this again and again, what on earth do they mean by transcending? How could you transcend the ego? I mean, isn't that what keeps you sane and functional? And they don't mean transcend the ego. They mean transcend something about the ego. They don't mean, you know, transcend consciousness. So I began studying consciousness about 10 years ago. And for consciousness, 75 of these things in the dictionary, and about 40 of them in freshman psychology books. This is what psychology is. It's doing this and doing that and doing this and so forth. And these egoic processes are adaptive, and they're problem-solving, and they're oriented to our needs. So our needs connect with these psychological problems. You feel a need, you have an issue to resolve or get or do something, and our egoic process is fulfilled with. Every time we do that, that leaves an egoic residue or an egoic trace of some kind. And this is how we build up our self. This is how our self-images are built up. This is how our personas are built up. And notice a very interesting thing, that this is not solely in consciousness, but it comes up into consciousness. This is a three-dimensional model, and it goes down below. But notice an interesting thing, that our personas and our self are very, very tied in this model to need fulfillment. And I think that's very important. The culture shapes how the needs are going to be fulfilled. So this is our main contact with culture. And if you are doing this kind of thing with your consciousness and breaking out of here, the way that you're going to be fulfilling your needs is going to be very different. It's going to open up. If you're in the wilderness, and you're in a stress situation or in a survival situation, and you're trying to find a way to deal with your needs, all this stuff up here doesn't work. Your habits of fulfilling them don't work. If you cross cultures, you suddenly find yourself in the middle of a village in the Ivory Coast, and all the moves you know how to make to fulfill your needs don't work. So your situation is shattered. Well, what happens in this consciousness is that there's a whole other zone here of consciousness that our culture knows very little about. And the word I would use for it is awareness. And there's a type of consciousness which is not oriented to fulfilling needs. And it's awareness. And the contemplative practices are what give it to us. And it has the amazing effect of dissolving right through every line that exists. That's why awareness practices are almost identical to the wilderness experience and are very comparable and parallel to the psychedelic experience. So we have with us, very unused in our culture, a system of consciousness that is healing and that we're not using. And that's my thesis or my model, my argument, my assumption, my work. That's what I'm trying to figure out. So archetypes are, so putting archetypes in this, so they're something called an archetype down here, which is really down in the depths of our psyche, you say. That's a statement projected from our egoic consciousness. That's what we project. When we are in our isolated individual ego, in other words, then we are going to see something from the depths as way over here. But when you are open in a wilderness experience or in a meditative state, when you are open and experiencing an archetype, it does not seem like it's over there at all. There's a sense of unity and there's a sense of oneness. And that unity and oneness is whatever the opposite of dualism is. That's what the experience feels like. So the experience of the archetype begins, and remember these scientists that are hanging out down here finding everything connecting, only it's not anything anymore. These are like energy fields, and that's exactly what Jung said about it. That's exactly what he said to Africa. He kept saying, they said, well, is it a thing? No, it's a field. They said, well, how does it, well, it vibrates. And he loved the word resonance. He said it resonates. And the very, very most exciting theories coming out of chaos theory and deep level physics is resonance theory. The resonance theory that are pulsing and resonating. So we're beginning to have the glimmers of what I think is a real map, at least a newer map than we have, that gives us a sense of our consciousness that isn't isolated. So I did an end run, and it's never worked, but I'm going to try it on you, and that's, so if you define consciousness as the individual part of the whole system, and if you define mind as all the rest, and you've cleared up the semantics in a very beautiful way. So people talk about the larger mind, and the consciousness is separate from that in most of us, occasionally drops into that larger mind. So I reserve the word mind for that aspect of our psyche which merges down in here with nature completely. So we have a language, at least the beginning of a language, to talk about how consciousness may or may not become synonymous with that larger mind. That mind that we're needing to be in touch with in order to get.
Are you saying consciousness is separate from that mind or is included in that mind?
Consciousness is both separate in that mind and potentially included in that mind. And right now, because I'm facing very serious problems right here, my consciousness is congealed away, really, in a larger mind. For every few minutes, for example, I take a breath and I relax and I realize this isn't going too bad for a minute. And I relax. Fear creates these things very clearly. I sense your consciousness, more or less. And so my consciousness has expanded into a larger, into this group mind that we have created, that exists. And if we were in the wilderness together for 2 weeks, sitting around fires and so forth, our consciousness would be very soft. It would have opened very much into dynamics of systems and watersheds and sunrises and the relationship of fire to sun and so forth in ways that would be very available to us, very vivid to us, and would be very much known, and would not need to be spoken about, because we would have shared those kind of experiences. So it's both. We're congealed into the consciousness, and then we can drop in and out of it, depending on all sorts of factors. Please.
Could you expand a little bit on what happens when you take people that, don't live in cities or not there? And bring them to the wild. What what takes place at the breakdown, at the surrender, whatever. Very different things with different people, and very vividly different things between men and women, and between older people and younger people. Everybody wants to get there.
Is there a typical
typical trip nowadays is 2 weeks and about 6 months of preparation. A lot of physical preparation. People have to be in really good shape, and they have to be able to carry a 50-pound pack and walk up and down mountains and stuff. And so that does a lot of opening up the mind, body, psyche, body stuff. But we go out. We sometimes hike 20 or 30 miles, sometimes 2 or 3. It depends on the capacities of the people. We often take children, sometimes old people. Last trip we took a young man with muscular dystrophy. And so we only went about 2 miles a day. The point is, you know, that's part of what this does is, where are we going? We're here. No, I know that, but I mean, where are we going by tonight? That kind of thing. So everything starts to get discombobulated and everything starts slowing down and all sorts of uncovering, in therapeutic language, all sorts of uncovering begins happening. Depends a lot on the leaders. If we encourage it, we almost instantly will have more than we really wish to handle. And we tend to discourage it, but we tell people this is not a therapy group, we're not here to. But the incidences of incest wounds and tremendous traumas in these stages, at least, wherever those things rest in the psyche, tend to come out about after 6 or 7 days. We divide men and women often in separate camps, and we play Native American forms to bring people back together again. And these forms are very, very powerful. They equalize gender and they equalize size and stuff like that. So people go through things. And they have wonderful times and terrible times and weep a lot. I'm sure you know, yeah. I do too. Well, the first concern, I don't believe I said that about nature, and I certainly don't believe that about nature, and I know it's said a lot, and it is over romanticized. I see nature, I see the mind, not the consciousness now, but the mind as an information system. It's beyond that, but we begin to understand it as it appears to us as an information system, and we're adapted to receive that information system. Bateson is the teacher about this, and he's very clear about it, and I think he's just right on. The information is of all kinds. One of the first experiences people have in the wilderness is a almost overwhelming sense of death. What's our biggest repression in our culture? It's death. It isn't sex, it's death. And immediately there's dead stuff lying all around. A student comes on a carcass of a deer. We go in very wild country, a carcass of a deer that a bear is eating. And we have a lot to deal with. I mean, you know, that kind of dead branch, dead logs and everything. I mean, it's dead and it's beautiful. Somebody says, it's not beautiful. And that's where the learning, that kind of thing. And the dangers, we're very careful, and we train very carefully about dangers and hypothermia equipment.
I was sloppier in the older days, and never have had an accident, but I've had close calls that I don't even want to think about. And I've learned to be impeccable as I know how to be with wool and with training and issues of hypothermia. I do take risks. I have alone time with people where I usually know where they are, but I sometimes don't know where people are. And most wilderness leaders don't do that. And I don't think you can have an alone time if somebody's watching over your shoulder. So I take a lot of risks. What was your other point?
The people who didn't come back.
One of the reasons I do this, other than the fact that psychedelics are illegal, is that this is a way. I also think meditation is the same way. There's something about the arduousness of the wilderness experience and the preparation and the body integration. Like, things are integrated as you go, more or less, or you can't really go. And it doesn't really happen. Leaving equipment is the first thing. That's the first trauma that must be faced. The things that I've taken out of people's packs you would not believe. And we have a strict list. You may not take anything out off this list. I mean, hair dryers and huge bags. I'll tell you a story. I had a guy that showed up with an extra day pack full of food supplements. He was very anxious about his diet, and he heard that we travel light, and our diet is carefully prepared, but it's light. And I said, "Well, you know, you're not taking that." And he said, "Well, you know, I am, because I have this." And so we go by consensus processes, more or less, and we're sitting there on this beach hour after hour with the group getting more and more pissed off, and we reached this tremendous thing. We're sitting there in the circle kind of scowling at each other, and most of the day went by, and he wouldn't give and I wouldn't give. Finally, he said, "Okay," I threw it in the middle, "I'll give it in if you'll give up your addiction." So I admit it's an addiction that you get. And I knew I was busted, but I didn't know where. You know, and I was very uneasy. And he said, "Your books." And I thought I was going to die. I felt my legs, I almost fainted. And I said, "What do you mean?" You know, the voice was up really high. "That's not an addiction. I mean, I got to have the book." You know, and paper and pencil and book. And they were onto me like sharks after blood, of course. And I learned that the subtleties of things that we take, every single thing we take with us in the wilderness is between us and the wilderness experience. But we're not fanatic. I mean, we have to go out and we have to come back. And part of the trip from the very beginning is preparing to come back. I've had a period of time where I had lots of serious depressions after leaving these trips. And I began realizing that's where the work is how to work back.
Will you talk more about that?
Whatever. Yeah, whatever. People, do you want to take a break?
Probably.
For then
you should take a little break.
Then I'll.
About 10 minutes.
I'll start with that. Question. Where were we? You had a question.
Well, we talked about it before, but I'm really interested in what your thoughts are about how you can best create transitions between and coming back to their normal world. And what ways there are to, incorporate those experiences.
I think it's characteristic of our culture to want an easy fix and a quick hit and a one-time-only salvation experience. I mean, it's embedded deeply in our culture. So a lot of people come on wilderness trips and they're not disappointed at first. It really happens, and they're just ecstatic, and they're just blown away, and they've experienced nature, the biggest peak experience they've ever had, and they're the ones that are I'm really worried about when they come back. Because they crash. They come back and they drop right back inside the egoic boundaries, we could, we might say in this language. They drop inside the egoic boundaries. You know, it's the Esalen weekend phenomenon. It's the workshop weekend. A lot of people know about this, you've experienced it. You get very jazzed and excited, and then there's your family again, and there's the garden, and there's your job, and Kresho, you know, and it's a dualistic world back here, and the habits are all there, and so nothing has really changed. When I started incorporating meditation and yoga on our wilderness trips, we simply stopped having depressions. And that's my simple answer. In other words, the more I do meditation and yoga in my own life and with other people, the less we really need wilderness to do what the wilderness does. So they become really synonymous in terms of healing and opening. The wilderness is a very beautiful place to meditate. And so is your backyard, or so is your closet, or wherever. And so people who develop a practice, one of the things we now insist on is that you have to have a practice. People say, what do you mean a practice? You know, well, meditate. Well, is jogging okay? You know, we go through that. And well, yeah, that's okay for starters. And also then developing a continuing relationship with the wilderness and with nature, with using these insights. One of the things we do very simply is getting up with the sun. And what the mystics said, I had an encounter once with, never mind this story, but the mystics often say, of all the ways we see humans worshiping, what makes the most sense is worshiping the sun. They don't say it makes any sense at all if you listen carefully to what they're saying, but of all the ways we see, of all the ways we see humans worship, worshiping the sun makes the most sense. Getting up with the sun is an incredible experience, that very profound nature, and you can do it wherever you live. Most people don't. Most people just really shine it on. In the wilderness, you really can't help it, but especially if you get up on a peak, get people up at the first crack of light, push them up to the mountain, you know, freezing cold, and there comes the sun. You do that 3 or 4 times in a row, and you can get hooked on it. And it's a good thing to get hooked on. It's a good way to start the day. So those are the kind of things you can continue when you come back. Jumping in cold water. I know this is starting to sound kind of outward boundish, but jumping in cold water is something you can do here as well as the wilderness, and it's just as exhilarating here. I know that'll come as a great surprise to some people. You know, it has to be a mountain river. You know. Not really. So the things you can do that'll keep that vitality and that'll keep that sense of your body and of being awake and of being tuned into the cosmos, that you have to struggle a little bit in the city, because you know, we're addicted to comfort, but it's possible, you know. Teach people that. Yes.
Yeah, I have actually 2 questions in question. The first one, you need to get out of the boundaries. How do your programs compare to the
I require the graduate students with whom I work have outward bound or comparable training. That's how much I respect what they do. Philosophically, I used to be worlds apart. They now argue with me that we're not that far apart. Their basic philosophy used to be conquer nature, conquer your fear, become a man by conquering nature. And they would put people in stress. They would increase the stress, rappelling up cliffs and so forth. They would do anything they could to increase the stress to the edge of safety. I think that's irrelevant or absurd or counterproductive or whatever. I'm interested in connecting with nature. And I really see it as a yin-yang difference. I really feel a much softer, receptive approach instead of a conquering approach. Having said that, I think there are populations of people, sometimes women, and sometimes kids at risk in cities, who that kind of discipline we're so used to being, I'm not talking about women now, but kids, we're so used to being frightened and in challenging situations that the wilderness, it's like methadone instead of heroin. You know, it's still a drug, that way to do that, and they still get off on the adrenaline rushes and stuff like that. But it's in a more safer, open environment. We work with lots of youth at risk. It's a huge business in this country, as somebody said. There's 12,000 groups in this country taking people out to the wilderness. That's problem number two or three. It's way up there on the list because the resource can't sustain that. There's too many people now for it to be wilderness, using wilderness. And now we have all people like me and all my students starting to train other people to lead more and more wilderness trips. It gets, it's not wilderness. I'm working I'm working on it. It's very primitive now, but I'll tell you one thing about Wilbur, which I like to share, and it's kind of one of those neat little twists of phrases that people writing books think is going to get on the back cover, you know, or something like that. But Wilbur has been taken apart by people because of his dependency on hierarchy. And he's misunderstood a lot because there's political hierarchy and there's biological hierarchy and there's evolution and there's development of children that does appear, you might say, that people, that infants unfold in a hierarchical manner from no consciousness to consciousness, and that the human, that life has unfolded on the earth from simple forms to more and more complex, and you could see that as hierarchical, not the political kind of hierarchy, which means dominance, which is what's so problematic in gender relationships. So Wilbur is all in and out of that argument. What fascinates me is that in this model, the egoic processes are connected to needs. And I think the one thing I really think Maslow is 100% right about is that our needs fall into hierarchical forms of fulfillment. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is still, after all of these years, in every freshman psychology textbook, and it works. Our needs appear to be hierarchically organized. In other words, it's very hard to have to be developing, fulfilling your spiritual need when you're starving to death. In other words, that's the hierarchy of needs. Well, if the needs are hierarchical, and then they're being fulfilled through these egoic processes, then the maintaining structure of our egoic consciousness, this egoic residue, more or less what Jung called the persona, will be tuned into hierarchical things. And as it projects itself onto this, to try to explain it, it will see hierarchies. And that's how projection, like everything we're seeing, more or less, is projection from whatever equipment we have going here. If this stuff is bound by egoic consciousness need fulfilling, it's going to see hierarchies everywhere we look. If it's open to awareness processes, you're not going to see hierarchy. And indeed, the famous gurus and saints and contemplators don't see the world hierarchically at all. It's a peculiar Western European American phenomenon to see the world so passionately hierarchical. And I believe it has to do with the fact that our consciousness is dominated by need-fulfilling process. And on and on. I could go on and on with that. It gets very complicated. Yes. 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 Nature and women as nature, as Susan Griffin is teaching us. And yes, that's exactly the point. That is when you read philosophy textbooks and you try to read what they say about dualism, it gets very abstract. Very fast, the mind-body problem. And so you see it as an abstraction. But if you get into the juice of it, into the experience of dualism, that's the first one you run into, at least in my experience, is the consciousness and the unconsciousness, or the what I'm calling consciousness and mind. And then then is when I weep. You know, we are cut off from this incredible source of wisdom and beauty and pain and terror and so forth. But the information we need to survive, you know, is existing. We're floating in it. And we're cut off from it. And that's our dilemma. I mean, that's the way I would define our dilemma in our particular time in history. I would be a little loath to go down that road. But the structure, the construction of this for Julian James is through metaphor and analogy. And there's a whole lot of interesting things you could say about that. That's also the belief of all the artificial intelligence guys. And most people who are fairly close to consciousness studies also, yes, it's metaphorical, it's analogistic. In other words, this is reflective of this broader reality out here. It's not the broader reality. It's reflective of it, and it's a metaphor of what we have in our consciousness. What pops out into our consciousness, our awareness right now, is a metaphor for something over there. I think that's a dualistic statement, so I think he tends to be dualistic. I think he's onto a lot of neat ideas. And just someone with the gall to stand up and say consciousness is only 4,000 years old and to make a really good case for it, you know, I'm charmed by his kind of academic courage. I mean, the academic world, tends to be so boring. I mean, to have anybody come up with an idea that great, you know. I don't know. I guess I'm leaving the university so I can say this, but the university seems to be the last to know, you know, about everything, and I always wonder about that. That makes me sad.
It seems like
I'm perhaps going to begin to sound like a fundamentalist Buddhist or something, but I really would recommend meditation. And, I remember some years ago, a woman expecting a child asked me what I would recommend she could do, for the childbirth experience she was going to have. And I spoke from my intuition, and I said, meditative practice. And then I looked into that answer, and I realized the essence of most meditation practice is letting go. Basically what it is. And if all the things a woman needs to do in the throes of childbirth is to let go. And it's the opposite of what you tend to want to do, which is fight it. And you have to surrender to it. Otherwise, if the process doesn't happen, it's my understanding of it. And so I think letting go is a practice of meditation, and it's why the return, you know, is so easy for people who have that kind of practice or who are developing. I don't know about that. I can't really say. It doesn't for me, but I think it does. It might for some people. I really couldn't answer that. It's a good question.
Yeah, I was thinking for myself, it's on meditation. It's, as you say, instead of grasping onto that and holding on, release that go. You go into that experience instead of hanging on to it. Mm-hmm. I guess that space, for me, that space of opening up. And if you don't let go, you don't have that new that space for that new experience to incorporate it before you can integrate into your other life. That's how it
is. Yeah, I would say more or less that same thing. The defenses around this, you know, what Freud called ego defenses, are well studied and well mapped. And apparently quite accurate. I don't think it's understood exactly how they fit in a larger system, but the idea is that we will definitely hold on to whatever we got, whatever's happening, and our habits of consciousness are something we're going to really hold on to. That is not just sort of like an addiction, that is an addiction. That's a major addiction. And so, but what I really see the wilderness is somewhat like a 12-step program. And the 12-step program, you know, fits this kind of model very well. One of the first things you do is surrender to a higher power. You can call the higher power what you want. The higher power, or the larger reality, there is the mind. And if you don't have a sense of it, or don't allow yourself to open up to it, you're not going to do anything at all. Nothing's going to happen. Every now and then, students, you know, the preparation tends to, you know, build up a certain kind of readiness, and so people get ready, and that part of getting ready is to go out there a little bit. But I've had students who are fantastically skilled at spending the entire time avoiding any possible expansion of consciousness in any way. You know, they bring in secret things in their pockets, and secret things in their packs, and secret books that they read, you know. And secret ways of remaining totally egoic the whole time, and identification things. What I try to do with those people is trick them. You know, they'll say, "Well, what do we do? What do we do?" And so I'll say, "Well, I'm doing this research project, and I'm studying the rocks in the river here that are about head size between that trail and this trail, and I've gotten only about halfway down. And here's a piece of paper and a clipboard. Count them, you know." And so I'll go, "Okay, something to do, you know." To be standing in the middle of the river counting the rocks. I mean, these are not the brightest of students, but they'll be doing that. And so about halfway, you know, 20 minutes it takes, sometimes an hour, you know, for hard cases. And I can just see them kind of standing in the river after a while, and they're starting to kind of look around. And all of a sudden they'll frown and look over at me, and they'll come walking over, you know. Think, "Are you pulling my leg?" And it's usually a wonderful, joyful kind of moment. So then we can talk about what we're here to do.
I'd like to change the line of questioning a little bit. I'm really concerned about the ecology on a global level. You know, they're telling me that all the forests in South America will be gone in 6 years. Driftnet, fishing is devastated the oceans. You know, what you mentioned about the sound, and on and on. Through archetypes, transformation, synchronicity, that there's some bridge we can cross. Is there, you know, I guess I'm looking for the ultimate answer to this dilemma. I understand that we've always looked at Mother Nature as, I was my mother, she's going to clean up after me and she'll be terrible. I think it's a fallacy that this is happening. How can we bring this understanding to the power of the decision?
Well, I don't think you'd be asking the question if you didn't have some hope or some idea yourself. And we all have to find an answer to that question, in my opinion. I mean, I passionately want you and everyone here and everyone I run into and everyone to find an answer to the question. It's in the interest at least of my genes, you know, and their future survival, speaking that way. I don't know of any one way. Find a model that works better than the ones we have. That's one thing. Find a practice that is healing. Find a way to connect to the wisdom wherever you can find it. Trust your intuition that you're finding wisdom. Experience the fullest mind that we have available to us. I don't think we have available to us all realities. I really don't. I think eagles' realities and dolphins' realities, I don't think we know anything about them. We're so arrogant in our myopia and our consciousness that we project this onto the entire Mother Gaia and animals and everything else. So you can withdraw the projections and so on. There's a whole list of things to do. And I think, you know, it's just a lame answer. We have to find our own way to do that and connect. I think it's a critical time to put it in my life. And I think going off, you know, half-cocked into aggressive politics, I did that in the 1960s and early 1970s, and it didn't work then, and it wouldn't work now. I'm on the planning commission in my county, Jefferson County. I said to my friends and students, they said, what are you doing that for? And I said, I got all these theories. I'm going to connect them with county politics. Well, they don't connect. You may not be surprised to know. I don't talk this way. It's one reason I wanted to come down here. I wanted to talk to somebody. You know? I don't talk this way in the planning commission meetings. They play very, very hardball. Thursday night we'll decide the future of the non-federal forests in Jefferson County for the next 50 years. We'll decide what's going to be preserved as forest. And that's how fast this growth management thing is happening. And so that's part of an answer. The water quality coming down the streams into the Hood Canal where I live, that's part of the work. And I don't know. I don't know what else to do. So just do this kind of thing. Pray without ceasing. Meditate.
I was going to ask you a way to find out how to translate this to their language.
I was reading a statement from some recent magazine that said most people can't figure out how to deal with their own lives. How could they think that they could tell anybody else how to deal with their lives in words, you know, or something like that? I think by example is what really happens, and by friendships, and by willingness to really stay in. What I've tried to come to terms with in these models, I have another model that I don't have time to talk about, but it's a systems model that kind of fits and overlays on this. And I found that the systems language is much stronger for me and my work than the Jungian language and than the transpersonal language. The Jungian language is extremely rich and helpful. When I want to talk to scientists at the University of Washington, I don't talk Jung. Language to them. They won't talk to me, but they'll talk systems. So I can translate Jung into systems language. I can translate archetypal talk into systems language and field language, because they're beginning to love all that kind of talk. And then we can have a conversation about new forestry. Well, forests are systems, for example, and the idea that everything belongs in the system that they've discovered so far is a marvelous new idea in the forestry department over here. And they're onto it. And to talk about form emerging in the system and having something to do with consciousness, I mean, we can kind of get into that. You know, I'm very careful to talk in cognitive terms and not more esoteric terms. Can't think right off the top of my head of a good example, but I'll... Something like that.
So you just talk about awareness of parts of the system instead of...
Yeah. Yeah, they're aware of the Heisenberg principle, of course, and they're all reading the books on chaos theory. They all love that. They all have computers, and they love to get that program that you have the little snakes that kind of cool, you know, like this, and they're all, you know, saying, wow, look at that. So they like to talk. They like to talk about consciousness and like what do you do to a system when you put in human awareness. The forest people, I'm working with the University of Idaho on developing a program, they are interested in such questions as different wildlife, is the consciousness different and does it have an effect on the system? The reason they are, they train all the wilderness rangers in the country, just about University of Idaho at in Moscow. And they are swamped with people creating strange circles in the middle of the wilderness. I hope not too many of them are my former students. And they're doing things out there, and they can't handle it. They don't know if their people can't handle that. So they go in and tear down the circles. That was the first thing that they started asking. And then the second thing they started getting into is the numbers of people. And they're aware that there's a certain threshold that you do not have a psychological experience if there's more than, say, 10 people up that canyon. And they're boggled out of their minds. They say, well, why couldn't we have 20? Why couldn't we have 50? What difference does it make? Well, consciousness does something to that. No, come on, Joe, that's not, you don't have a time. And they're having conversations like that. And so there's an opening and there's some open doors. Meanwhile, you know, the planet is in a lot of trouble.
One more question.
Would I have time? Do I have time to read one poem and read one little thing before?
It's a kind of a closing thing.
That's it. Oh, you know, I think I left that. No, I didn't. Here it is. I had a thing I wrote. I was writing. I'm writing, working on a book on the wilderness experience, and I. This is a statement that came out about moments of integration. It might give you a tiny idea of. Well, this is an attempt at putting into words a very, very nice experience. Moments of integration, of being completely one with my surroundings, haven't happened in my life that much. And when it has happened, it has been as frequently out of wilderness as in. But the experience has always been one of being inside. Making love whenever and wherever, when it's completely right, has been the most common way in times past. But that's still more a communion, a commingling of forms, seen as separate. Here is one time of complete fulfilling integration in the wilderness. There were 12 of us on a warm June day along the upper reaches of the Middle Fork of the Eel River. As it happened, 6 men and 6 women, 2 of whom were sisters, one 22, the other 14, their father was among the men. We had done our work, played the games we knew would open us beyond our controls, astonished at how our precious assumptions could be so easily challenged. We had awakened our bodies by plunging daily in the still, frigid, snow-fed waters, awakened our souls in sweat lodges, awakened the sun from the peaks at dawn, chanted nonsense sounds alone and together that could not stay contained within our separate skulls. We had prayed and laughed and cried, had gone out alone like heroes on grail quests in search of dramatic visions, and had found instead tiny, perfect micro-wildernesses all around us, sensuous manzanitas, trunks rising like red-muscled limbs out of banks of chartreuse green moss, columns of ants dragging the last remnants of mayflies, small trout flashing in the pools, every little soon-to-be-dry brooklet. After such work on this particular day, our last before leaving, we scrambled over rocks and through the pools down the stream, naked, splashing, noisy beyond where we could be found, in our relief, unbeknownst to ourselves, moving further into our souls. We came upon a huge pool. It seemed bottomless. Shadings of blue-green darkening almost to black in the depths. Sheer walls of blue-gray slate rising 30 feet above either bank. Huge rounded boulders up and downstream over which the water poured into the pool in gushing waterfall and out downstream at the end of the pool. We felt silent without admonition, knowing instantly that somehow this would be the most sacred, the place of furthest reaching for this day, for this trip, for this time in our lives, perhaps in our entire lives. No one spoke as one by one we entered the pool. Later we would remember that for the first time on the trip, the water did not shock us. We crawled under the hot rocks, warming our bodies on mounds and folds and curves we each found. Many of us slept for a time. Many later spoke of amazingly lucid dreams. After a time, we gravitated towards a large flat space on top of one of the rocks next to the pool and formed a circle, our habit over the previous 12 days. And then there was no distance, an openness into ourselves that was in an openness into each other, embracing the pool, going out and expanding circles to the wilderness, the other world, the whole earth, the universe. We looked frankly at each other, smiling, weeping, saw the other being seen by ourselves, being seen by the other. Some quietly spoke from their hearts. We sang some of the songs that had been most healing for us, blending in with the sound of the river. When a shadow passed over us, a rare golden eagle passed between us and the sun. Suddenly we saw that the shadows had lengthened along the canyon walls, and with a wild cry, someone leapt up and dove into the pool. We all followed, and the water was icy, shocking, our skin feeling taut. We walked slowly back to our camp and quietly made our lentil stew. The young sister said that night around our last fire, "Now I'm ready to go back to the crazy world. I could never let a day like this become a common thing." I wanted to express my thanks to you for letting me ramble around various areas, and I very much would hope that some benefit comes from this. Thanks very much. Yeah.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.